From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the writer Rick Bass traveled to Southwest Africa to see a black rhino, he understood how different that landscape would be from his surroundings in Montana, his home. But in his book, he says he was surprised when he arrived that he already had a pair of spectacles that would allow him to look at Africa. It turns out the stories were eerily the same. People trying to figure out solutions to save big, grand animals in the wild spaces they roam. The rhinos were the grizzlies of northwestern Montana. The only difference, he says, was time. And in the desolate Namib Desert, Bass says he found glimpses of hope. Today in the program, Rick Bass is joining us. His book is called The Black Rhinos of Namibia. We hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Rick Bass. We're talking about his latest book, The Black Rhinos of Namibia. When he traveled to Southwest Africa to see a black rhino, Bass says he knew the stories of Africa and the American West were not the same. But in the book, it says it turns out some of the stories were eerily similar, people trying to figure out solutions to save big animals in the wild spaces they roam. In the desolate Namib Desert, Bass says he found glimpses of hope in a time of ecological disaster. The book is about his experience of finding a black rhino, a 3,000-pound, nearly blind beast that lives off poisonous plants and goes for days without water. But it's also about the people who are trying to protect this species. Really, it's a meditation on extinction and survival. The book, again, is called The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Rick Bass is an environmentalist and the author of more than 20 books, including his latest. He's joining us today from the studios of Montana Public Radio in Missoula, Montana. And Rick Bass, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. What a kind and elegant introduction.
Well, thank you. I wanted to start first by talking about why you wanted to go to Africa, because you say in the book, really right off the bat, you write about this, that you had been kind of apprehensive about going.
Sure. From a literary standpoint, there have been a lot of folks who've lived in Africa and written well about Africa. From an environmental standpoint, there's been a great tradition of African writing, and I did not feel that the world needed another piece of writing about Africa. I went there as a writing instructor to talk to these students who are working with a field ecology program there from a Salt Lake organization, Round River Conservation Studies, and just kind of backed into the story for that way, and found that I did witness some amazing things that I felt, authorized or motivated to convey.
So you didn't think there. So you didn't go to write a book. You went to have this experience, and you. But yeah. I guess when you came back, did you figure I've got to write about this?
No, exactly. Yeah, I mean, just all this amazing stuff, you know, happens, and you see all these incredible stories that you want to share them.
In the book, there's this kind of reverence that you write about that you have for Africa, and this respect that you write about for the fact of its sheer survival, as you put it in the book. You say it's hard to say that Africa has necessarily prospered, but it's important to say that it's survived.
You know, that's a good point, and it sounds, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and there was often Africa was held up to my white bread culture as exhibit B of hard times and a rough spot. And that was certainly that's what I witnessed when I got over there. But it's in our own country also. There are a lot of people in hard spots and hard times. And it was very humbling to have experienced that most recent economic, ecological, social setbacks that we're kind of wading through right now, or not wading through, and then to go to a country that's pretty much been juggling those issues by a factor of 100, for a long time. It was humbling and educational.
Mm. You say that the United States country, as you say, much less tested, but already buckling and fragmenting. It seems like one of the themes in the book, this constant kind of, not comparison necessarily, but you're relating this place to that.
That's a really nice point. It's not a comparison, but it is a relation. Here is a country, here are villages and communities that have survived everything the world can throw at them. Here are species that have survived everything the world can throw at them, whereas in our new European version of this country, but even non-European, I mean, even the First Nations, Native people in this country are much more recently, residents than in Africa. And we know all this. I mean, it's a cliche to even talk this way, but to actually witness it, see it, inhale it was profound at every level.
You say that in the book, really simply, you say you went because you wanted to see a black rhino. And I wanted to explore that because it seems in some ways it turned out that it was kind of bound up in how you understand the condition of the planet. I want to have you read a section here in a moment, but one of the sections here is that you write about is that you wanted to see the face or at least a glimpse of the world to come. Maybe read this section first, because I wanted to talk about that idea.
Sure. Without quite understanding it at the time, I wanted to see also the face or at least a glimpse of the world to come, to witness the utter signature of environmental paucity. One of the largest species pushed to the maximum brink, the bitter edge that so many of our own species are hurtling toward here in the United States and elsewhere in the world. How far away are we, and so many of our endangered species, most notably, in my world, back in Montana, the grizzly bear, from that same precipice. Here, with the rhino, was a creature, the mythic made real, that, better than almost any other animal, could tolerate a world of almost supernatural heat and the extreme rarity of water. How many short years before we, even in the flush United States, might be entering such a future? Not just our grizzlies and our salmon, our cranes and darters and tanagers, but we, the people, perhaps frailest and palest among the species. How far that future? I wanted to see the real creature, and I wanted to see the myth, too. I wanted to see an animal so stolid in the world, even at the edge of apocalypse. I wanted to see what one journalist called rhinos on the moon. I wanted to wake up, or perhaps the opposite, go to sleep and enter another dream, and to then stand as close as possible to the edge of the dream of that other world, close enough to smell the heat and bake in the dust and dazzle, and to hear the click of hooves and even the shifting of muscle. I wanted to stand right at the edge of that world, no more than one step away, so that I might even choose to enter it, to witness the creatures that have perhaps lived far beyond their time, as if even the rhinos, having survived and flourished in their old world, have themselves come now to the edge of another dream, one that they too must choose to step into and pass through, and in so doing be saved or lost.
So that edge of the world, are you sensing that are you sensing that here in the United States, because the grizzlies have been a concern of yours for a good part of your life, are you sensing that we're approaching that time, or at least you're anticipating that time for the grizzlies, and that's what Africa was doing for you, was sort of maybe in some deep way preparing you for that, I guess?
That's so well said or well noted. I certainly don't ever come right out and say that in the book, but that's absolutely the ethos or fear. You know, you turn toward your fears. You also turn toward other places for solutions or for hope. And it was both fear and hope that I thought, okay, well, you know, here's something that got down like our grizzlies to, or like the grizzlies in the Yak, down to double-digit populations, and 92 rhinos in this one section of Damaraland, 15 grizzlies in 1 million-acre valley called the Yak. I wanted to go see it, and it sounds like, you know, kind of perverse tourist bucket list kind of thing. I wanted to see such a creature that the world had spent 4 million years sculpting. You know, if it was going to go from 92 to 72 to 32 to zero, I did want to see what that looked like.
Describe the setting. I mean, you referenced before how a journalist had said rhinos on the moon, and people always refer to the moon, I guess, when they're talking about this section. But I guess this is the case. This is so much of your work, it seems, Rick Bass, that place is a character here. And, of course, you can't disconnect. Certainly in the case of the rhino, you cannot disconnect that place from that creature, I guess.
Absolutely not at all. And to describe it, people, when they describe the Namib Desert, they do use the word lunar and moonscape. It's a basalt prairie. The basalt was formed 130 million years ago. You know, volcanic extrusion came up, and the magma came up, and the lava spread across this very flat, planar surface, where it has remained flat and planar for that period of time, and just this very slow weathering. It's one of the driest places on Earth, an inch or two of rain per year, so very, very slow weathering. The basalt has weathered uniformly. It's almost uniformly sorted into these fist-sized cobbles for as far as you can see, with just these interstices of space between each cobble. It's mesmerizing to the human brain and actually soothing in a strange way, almost an orchard-like way. You're looking out at sameness to the horizon and real calm and beautiful. Barren black red landscape with great heat, you know, radiating off those oven hot rocks. It's no place like it. And it's so different from the green lush rainforest of home, with its folds and mountains and valleys and ravines and ridges. This was just flat to the horizon. And for that landscape, as you point out so accurately, to have yielded a rhino, to have sculpted, created, crafted, shaped a rhino. Just really, really gave me a lot to think about. You know, if you or I were to take that landscape, and which is again very dry, no soil, no very, very slow weathering, how would we distribute life across that landscape? I know I would be very conservative. I would say, okay, I want life to be here. The life force, whatever it is that generates life, whether it's a chemical yearning for carbon and hydrogen to bond, whatever the thing about the Earth that makes life be here right now, it just seems to me so improbable that force would coalesce into something that weighs 3,000 pounds and, as you noted, goes days without water, eats poisonous plants, which is about the only thing that grows there, is this one giant bush, the euphorbia bush, that nothing else can eat. It's very toxic. I would not have done it that way. Life force. I would have hedged my bets and had a few dung beetles and an awful lot of butterflies and some little blossoms here and there and maybe a rabbit, and then worked my way up, you know, maybe a small ungulate and so forth, maybe some birds. But I would not have just had, you know, exhibit A, euphorbia, poisonous bush, and exhibit B, a 3,000-pound animal. It was really fantastic. And Stephen Jay Gould, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had never thought about a rhino in that sense, in the sense, as you say, it's an evolutionary extravagance in that way.
Yeah, oh, what a great phrase. Yeah, totally. Or it seems so to us. It seems so to me anyway.
Yeah. Well, you talk about how it had 50 million years to adjust to the poison of this one plant. And talk about the connection between, because there's this... You write about, and I wanted to kind of get at this thing, you write about the pyramid, the sort of ecology, these insights that you have that about this cycle in nature that, you know, after the old forest disappears, there's this sense that, you know, a grassland will come to return in its place. But then you're writing about, what if there are cycles beyond the ones that we perceive, that if the pyramid is in some way different, and it seems like it's different for the rhino in some way, because it coexists with this really austere, nasty plant. That's why it exists, I guess.
Yeah. No, it's almost to consider it is almost the opposite of the model that we learned in school with the algae or the trophic levels being the broad base at the bottom of the pyramid, and then working up as the sun loses a tenth of its transfer through inefficiency to the things that eat the grass, and then the things that eat the things that eat the grass, and then the things that eat the things that eat the grass, and then we're way up there at the top, and so there's this our existence, our humans' existence, or top tier, top level predators' existence, is hugely inefficient, utilizing all of this photosynthetic and life transfer through different stages to get up to the top of the pyramid. We're a very extravagant, expensive species ourselves, but looking at some species, such as rhinos, or in our country, grizzlies, elephants, others that manipulate the habitat and redistribute the flow of wealth, the flow of resources through the ecosystem, it's almost like they have this God status in a Garden of Eden. It's like they, for everything else to exist, these giants have to be there first. With these basic, simple stories. The Round River biologist Chris Filardi just waxes rhapsodic about something as unromantic a term as fecal transfer, but this huge importation and exportation of resources and redistribution. The rhinos eating these giant poisonous plants that would otherwise not be have any carbon redistributed in a very very nutrient poor, nutrient lacking ecosystem. The rhino is the only thing that can take a euphorbia bush and break it down and spread some of that wealth across this desperate, hungry land. It's going to take who knows what will come next. Maybe all those flowers and other smaller things will now come out of the garden of this relationship between the rhino and this poisonous bush. But it may take another 100 million years. It may take, who can say what's 2-3 days, what's 2 or 3 millennium. It was a fantastic experience to be walking between the rhinos and the euphorbia and seeing the process going on.
I found this really intriguing in the book, because you write this, you ask this question: what if there is a place in the model for a species that resides just beyond this known pyramid? And you say not quite the creator or an original designer, but something closer, a species operating, you say, surviving on some other plane or layer of logic. What do you mean?
Without getting too metaphysical.
You can get as metaphysical as you want, Rick Bass, but go ahead.
Well, it is Pledge Week. There's this basic ecology of life that goes on. It comes down to really the question of, what is humanity? Why are humans different? What's our gig?
Yeah.
How are we different? Are we different? And it has to do with, it has to do with a lot of things, but the yearning / loneliness / hunger that we have, that's beyond food, shelter, and water. It's beyond social bonds. It is something, beyond that pyramid. Do we fill a spot? Do we emit a crackling radiance of that lostness or that spiritual questioning that others don't? And if we do, there's got to be a place for it. There's got to be a reason for it to be here, unless it's just some strange experiment off the tree of life. And I suppose that's entirely possible also. But there's just not much in the world that does not either have a fit or is very actively in the business of making itself fit the world. There's so little that doesn't fit, even in the moment, that it seems... the pyramid model seems a little too easy. It's like the Spinal Tap movie. There's got to be 11, doesn't just go to 10. There's got to be something beyond the tip of the pyramid, maybe the tip of the tip. I don't know.
It's interesting. You say that there are different places in the book where you write about these times when you think about a designer or something, anyway, someone who may have designed all of this. And you say there's this kind of yearning for the miraculous. Is that kind of what you're getting at? That you like that there is something kind of miraculous about this world, about nature?
I do like that, and I sure do. And I like the movement of things beyond the realm of the coincidental. And when you're out in the woods, you see it, you feel it. I feel it strongly, and you see it. commonly. We, you know, you see it in nature, and you see it in human relationships too. The people you meet when you meet them, and the crossing of paths and so forth. It's a random, chaotic world, and it's a made world. And you know, back to that question about the pyramid. I think as humans, we kind of navigate between. You know, we're so newly arrived. We're 180,000 years old. Everything else is millions and millions of years old. We don't have the deep instinct. We don't have the guidelines, the instincts and genotypes and phenotypes to navigate this, again, an overused metaphor, garden that we've stumbled into or crawled up into and in which we find ourselves and trying to make our own fit. We just got here, and that's wonderful and terrifying and exhilarating and lonely, and again, the word frightening. And that's what you see when you behold these the megafauna, you know, the ones who actually shape the landscape and shape the lives of all the others around them, whether it's elephants or mountain gorillas or black rhinos. You see something in their bearing that is the calm, ancient dignity of having survived, not just survived, but crafted themselves beautifully to fit an extremely challenging landscape, and they have the authority of a deep existence that we don't have yet, and that it's why we feel so awed and calm in their presence. You know, they have what we hope someday in the far distance to have.
Rick Bass is with us. His book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the writer Rick Bass. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. He's joining us today from the studios of Montana Public Radio in Missoula. I wanted to ask you, was there ever a moment when you wondered if you actually would see a rhino when you were in Africa?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. That's I'm such a Pollyanna optimist kind of person, like I'm a hunter, and if I go out hunting and don't see an animal, I think, well, you know, it was a nice day to be out, or look at that beautiful blossom. And so there was a lot of that going on, thinking, you know, it's a long shot you're going to see a rhino, but just be glad. And so my goal was to see even a rhino track, and we saw a lot of tracks. They leave really distinct tracks out there, but for several days we did not see a rhino. We looked a long time, and you know, the usual stories. Mike, our guide, had... Oh, you should have been here last week. They were everywhere. That kind of thing.
Yeah. But you say there's a part of you that was strangely pleased that you couldn't find rhinos, that you only saw tracks.
Yeah, no, I'm just that way. I'm going to put a positive spin on whatever comes at me. And then the longer we went without seeing rhinos, I just kept saying, isn't this great? We're not seeing rhinos. But look at all this country where they could be. They could be over the horizon. And that's kind of what they are. You know, they are... very, very widely distributed, and that's part of the deal, to not see them.
You write about being anxious. You write about being excited. And you even say that there were times when you found yourself having a hard time actually imagining the experience of actually seeing a rhino.
Totally, because, again, how do you, you know— in middle age, how do you prepare for seeing something that you've never seen before?
Right.
That's not a real common experience.
Right.
You know, they're cartoons, they're myths, they're archetypes. But I don't know if that's what Peter Matheson, I think he was probably talking about a lot of things at once. But when he said, have you seen the snow leopard? No, isn't it wonderful?
Right.
You know, it engages the mind, the idea of looking for and hoping to see something that you have no relation to, no context for, is rare and felt pretty darn healthy to my mind, is what it felt like.
Well, there's this lovely moment in the book where you're staring down into this valley, and all of a sudden you encounter this group of giraffes, and your response is you say you burst out laughing.
Oh yeah, no, it's just like being a kid where the world just doesn't make sense, and of course the world makes perfect sense, but to you it's the most ludicrous thing you. that you could imagine. It was Alice in Wonderland, Fantasyland. Why are these animals looking down on trees? Why, you know, every other animal I've ever seen is walks under the trees. These animals are looking down on, you know, real living trees. It was, yeah, that was just the natural response was to burst into laughter. I remember my daughters did the same thing, snorkeling for the first time over a coral reef. They put their mask on and looked down at all the coral and those colorful fish darting through, and you could just hear them underwater, that gurgling, bubbling laughter. It was just this pure response.
Well, it wasn't quite laughter, but you say when you did finally see one, there was a female, great silver tank moving slowly across the plains is how you put it. You say you just grinned ear to ear. Now, she was far off, but can you describe that moment when you first, that, there it was now.
Yeah, and again, to, as you pointed out, this landscape is almost featureless to the horizon, so that it does a strange thing to your mind to not have vertical fixture points to give frames of reference and relation. And gradually, over the days, you become accustomed to that. Your body loosens, your mind loosens. You're more comfortable, looking beyond things. And to have had those preceding days be filled with absence, just the beauty of the landscape in absence, and then to see so far away the tiny signature of this thing entering that sphere of sight, it was just right. It came in very slowly and gently and far away to pierce the consciousness of that. That viewscape, that mindscape, that landscape that was all wrapped together. She was a long way off, and we did not think that she would get any closer, but eventually she did.
Yeah. You say in the book it was a different feeling from encountering a bear or a wolf, which you have encountered in the wild.
Yeah, and again, I think mostly just spatially related. Yeah. At home, when you see animals in the woods, there's some degree of closeness. It could be... could be 30 or 40, 50 yards. It could be, it could be several hundred yards, but not, it's not a, you don't see them miles distant.
She's immense, of course. And you say she appeared more graceful than you expected. She had a calf with her. And you write about how she comes closer. Obviously, of course, hasn't detected that you're there. And
right.
You say that there was this moment, she gets closer and closer, and you write about how at some point, you say the myth of our invisibility gets stripped away. What do you mean?
Yeah. Well, we'd been watching her for half an hour or whatever, and they have very poor eyesight. We could see her through the binoculars at 3 miles. She could not see us, then 2 miles, then 1 mile, and then half a mile, and she's kind of coming in our direction.
Yeah.
And at some point, there was a shift where, oh, isn't this great? We're right in her way, she's going to come right over the top of us, and even something as nearsighted as a rhino, eventually we'll be able to see you at point blank, and that we thought that would be really interesting when that happened.
Read this section about encountering her, would you?
Sure. In our new space of fear and beauty, we're able to observe her in a way we would not otherwise have been able to. Everything is revealed here at last, and I find myself astonished by each individual part of her, as well as by the greater whole that stands before us. Her eyes are filled with intelligence and with anger, but not quite menace, though, too, she appears to be possibly considering or building toward menace. In our suspension, there is time to note the bristles at the end of her tail, like those of a horse's, and the strange curves and articulations of her bowed legs, in from the shoulder toward the top of the knee, then sweeping out from the knee toward the ankle, and then back inward yet again at the tops of the huge and all-important, all-durable feet. Out on this landscape, her strange toes do not look strange, but instead perfect. The horns, of course, command our obvious and immediate attention. But what I find myself observing most closely about her is her color and musculature, particularly her front shoulders, which support so much weight. I had assumed from everything I'd always heard that a rhino was armor-plated, segmented as if with scutes and scales, like a great reptile, even a dinosaur. but staring at her now, I find her to be swathed in muscle, not armor. Her skin appears creamy, with the detail of musculature one might expect in a classic marble sculpture. Michelangelo's David comes to mind. And the horizontal sunlight heightens the details of the musculature, even while softening the tone. She is brilliant, luminous, and she is made of muscle, not scales or stone. Mike is watching her most closely of all, in that same mesmerized state of rapture, yet I see no fear in him, only joy and wonder, leavened with concern for the rest of us in case things turn ugly. And as the mother's musculature tightens and she cants her head that 2 or 3 degrees to the left, fixing on us now, Mike senses the coming charge and says, "Okay, stand up, but stay together and back up slowly."
Then you write about how she takes the step and how movement is suspended, how you are frozen there. And it's interesting you describe it as mercy. You say suspended mercy, waiting to be delivered.
Yeah, no, it was totally her choice. We were in the wrong. We were between where she and her calf were going and where she was. And we had rudely not announced ourselves to her. And then all of a sudden there we were in her face. It was all her call.
You write about, the book, of course, is about the efforts at trying to save rhinos. And one of the things is the efforts to sort of round them up and relocate them, you know, repatriate them, as you put it in the book. And it raises questions that you explore. And there's this kind of heart-wrenching hypothetical that you pose that I wanted to ask you about. What if you say, what if the only chance you had to save the grizzlies, for example, that are dwindling, you know, in your area in Montana, what if your only chance was to round them all up and put them behind a fence? And, and you say, would I do it? Or, as you put it, would you try and ride things down to the bitter end, never giving up, holding out some last hope? Do you think you have an answer for that hypothetical, for that question?
I do have an answer, I think, for that hypothetical question of what I would do. I do not have an answer for what I think is right or wrong. I just know my nature to hold on to hope until hope is gone and then squeeze it tighter. And so I really have no position to judge the more analytical or scientific or pragmatic-minded folks who you know, who are kind of militaristic and just swoop in. Let's gather up the last. Let's change their genetic structure. To me, wild animals and people, for that matter, are so wedded to landscape that if you have to start altering, taking them out of their landscape, or start altering them in a way that the landscape has not altered them, it's not the same species anymore. Mm. It's not the same memory. It's not the same animal. It's something different. And it's just, if you have to do that, you've lost. And so I know that's the indulgence, the luxury of a stubborn purist idealism. I'm not saying it's right. It's just what I would choose.
Yeah,
I would choose extinction over artificial alteration and manipulation.
A rhino without its landscape is not a rhino, is how you put it.
That's in my world, yeah. But, you know, what does the rhino say? I don't know.
Yeah.
I know what I say. But the antidote to this question, it is a hypothetical. There are still answers. If we can protect big chunks of vast wild country that these incredibly crafted, time-sculpted species need, the grizzlies in Yellowstone and the yak and black rhinos in Namibia and so forth, then the world will continue to shape them at its own organic and elegant and sophisticated pace rather than our punch-button, push-button, last-gasp measures. And it's all the difference in the world to me. It's the difference between the graceful and the awkward.
And the conservation community has really done a remarkable thing. I mean, you write about how they have had to address these heart-wrenching choices and decisions, but you talk about how what you found was a kind of sense of imagination and creativity. I mean, one of the things, for example, you write about is that they made the rhinos more valuable to the poachers alive than dead.
Yeah, you know, and again, a simple, not simple, actually a very, you know, cutting-edge conservation model, one that we're trying, still experimenting with in this country, is how do you provide economic incentives for for your goals rather than always imposing economic cost on your goals. And quite simply, because rhino's horns were sold so cheaply by the poachers, it was pretty easy to say, we'll pay you double if you don't kill them. And these same poachers with the tracking skills who could find the rhinos out in the desert were now tasked with following them around and staying some safe, hidden distance behind and just kind of being guardian angels, just watching over them and protecting them for, you know, $2 a day instead of $1 a day.
That seems to be the thing that gave you hope, right? Is that they could sort of be creative. They could find a way, use their imaginations to find some way out of this.
Exactly. It's a good model, but the thing beneath the model, the desire, the creativity to make up a solution on your own rather than looking somewhere else that's what life does. It survives. Yeah. It doesn't look some life forms and processes imitate or emulate, but a lot of it looks at what it's got in front of it and then figures out how to assemble those resources and those conditions into a future, into life, and keep life going. It's a very cool force to be around. Mm.
Do you think you understand at all the kind of I want to use the word perverse appeal of that horn? Maybe it's not that, but the rhino's horn. Do you think you understand what the appeal is? You know, it's practical in some ways, but it also seems mythic in some way too.
No, it really that's a great question. I think what the eye fixes on when you see a rhino for the first time is the whole of the animal. I mean, it's like that old story about the elephant. You don't just notice the tusk or the trunk or the ears, the tail, the legs. You think, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
But at close range, the horn becomes quite what the eye fixes on. It is the weapon. It is what they use to defend the calves against hyenas with. And it is this iconic symbol of force. The eye fixes on that at close range, but at a far range, you're seeing the whole animal. It's pretty interesting.
Mm. There's this other question, of course, that comes up because this is another method that some conservationists have thought of to save the rhino, and that is just remove the horn. But if a rhino without its landscape is not a rhino, you know, what is a rhino without its horns? That's another question you ask.
No, I agree. And again, I don't mean to suggest that I think I'm right about this. I just know what is honest within me. I don't want that to be – that's not a solution for me. If you have to cut their horns off to save them, why not just go strap horns on hippopotamuses? I mean, you know, where do you – it's not – the horn is so much a part of the rhino that if we get down to that point, we've lost. And ironically, even the when they were conservationists were sawing horns off of rhinos to try and protect them, there were some studies that showed that the mothers were having slightly greater difficulty defending their calves against hyenas, less than you would imagine. Turned out the mother was going to do whatever it took to protect the calf, and well, never mind that 4 million years of evolutionary investment. I'll just make it up on the fly. I'm still going to protect the baby. But there was some incidental, statistically very small but significant increase in mortality. But also what happened was the poachers, when they would track down one of these rhinos that had the horns sawed off, they'd kill it anyway, sometimes out of spite, other times so that they didn't make the mistake of following that same animal's tracks again for days on end to come to in the poachers' minds, fruitless end.
You know, it's so interesting that you talk about love. You say it's a question of love and love's nemesis, you say, denial. But you say, what kind of love for a species or for anything would it take to make such a decision, you know, to separate a thing from its home and from the very essence that had made it?
And that is the heart of your question. I'm talking about space and landscape and the people who make the decision on the other side, those decisions on the other sides of things, who also love the species, perhaps the species more than the landscape, they're looking at it through a lens of time, and they're trying to buy time. They're thinking, what's 100 years? We'll just keep these hornless rhinos in the zoo for 100 years, and then we'll bring them back to their native landscape. And they have a point, because over the course of 130 million years desert evolution or 4 million years of rhino evolution? What is 100 years of captive stock captivity? It's the difference between artist and scientist, I think, and there's not a right or wrong, I don't think.
I want to come back to the moment when you see the rhino, and there's that moment where really, as you say, it's her choice. She could charge or she can retreat, and it turns out she retreats, gallops away, and you talk about how that speed of her galloping away was really beautiful to behold. But you were left with this feeling, you say, that was kind of hard to describe, and it's another moment in the book that I want to have you read. Do you want to say something about this?
Oh, it was so lonely. It was so, and it also made me feel so brightly human in a way that we generally tune out. It was like, oh, this is what the human being is, this filament filled with longing and wanting some tenuous or intangible connection to something that we don't even know what it is on the other side of that. But it was just, oh, you know, I just wanted her to come back. I did not want her to go away. Mm. And I didn't know why. It was just a very physical and mental and emotional wrenching. I thought, oh, I'm alive. I'm human. That's what it means to be human, is to feel this disappointment and wonder at the same time.
Read this for us, will you?
Sure. We watch as she and her calf enter the faraway screen of green, like arrows fired into its midst. How removed we are already from the real-time flesh and blood of them, the acrid scent and sound of them, the calf's confused mewing, and the scratch of gravel and stone. It seems to me that we have come through our own narrow wedge of possibility, our own dial of survival rotated but the width of one gear tooth, one click to the left or the right. The rhino deciding whether to charge that last 20 yards or to whirl and gallop 3 miles away. And in the freshness of our survival, as well as the beauty we have witnessed, there is among all of us an exaltation, a world's newness, that I find hard now to describe or even fully recall in flavor and tenor, in intensity and tone. I think that I would almost have to go back out on that same landscape to recapture it, to that precise spot, that one shallow depression on the steep slope of the red hill overlooking the watering hole. I think that I might need to be there at the same sun-going-down-fast time of day, too, in order to have the best chance of accessing that feeling again, returning to it as if in some small loop of days.
Rick Bass. His book is The Black Rhinos of Namibia, Searching for Survivors in the African Desert. He joined us today from the studios of Montana Public Radio in Missoula. Rick Bass, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. The show is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.